When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Bird Shop Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we talk quail hunting and more with Mike Sheffer. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 258. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bird Shop Podcast. Thank you for joining us once again. We got a great conversation coming up with our guest today, Mike Sheffer. We're talking plenty of quail hunting on today's episode. Before we get to that, I will quickly thank Patreon patrons of the Bird Shop Podcast. Those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show to keep these conversations coming your way. They get access to bonus content, some Patreon giveaways, and we send everybody some Bird Shop Podcast canned coolers and stickers. You can learn more about that and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Remember those upcoming events. Next week, the Southeastern Wildlife Expo down in Charleston, South Carolina. I am headed there next week. Hope to see some of you there. Come see us at the Upland Gun Company booth in the Quail Village at Brittlebank Park, along with some other great upland-centric exhibitors. And then shortly after that, we got Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic coming up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Don't forget Friday night, the offline at Pheasant Fest Onyx Hunt Party. That's at 9 p.m. on Friday, March 1st at Ramcota's Grand Rushmore Hall. Live music, chance to win some great prizes, public access pull tabs, free beer from Line of Kugels, and learn more about South Dakota's new public access to habitat program. On top of that, this week is your last chance to win a set of tickets to the Trampled by Turtles Pheasants Forever Concert for Conservation. That concert is Thursday night, sort of the kickoff night of Pheasant Fest. Onyx Hunt giving away a set of tickets to one lucky subscriber and a friend, VIP passes, one night lodging, daily admission to the 2024 Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. That contest closes on February 15th, coming up next week. There's a link to enter in the show notes, Pheasant Fest giveaway. Still got some time before February 15th to click that link and sign yourself up. Hope to see some of you at Pheasant Fest as well. But for now, let's shift our focus to today's conversation with Mike Sheffer, lifelong upland bird hunter, listener of the show, friend of the show. Mike and I caught up a week or so ago and talked lots of quail hunting and upland bird hunting focused retirement, bird dogs, and more. Let's get right into it. Welcome into the conversation and onto the Bird Shop Podcast, Mike Sheffer.
red light is on, Mr. Sheffer, and the coffee is fresh. It's a beautiful day where you are. I know that based on what you're telling me. Believe it or not, we actually got a dusting of snow last night. It looks a bit more wintry than it has the last week or so.
It's almost like spring here. The birds are calling, and like I said, if it wasn't, the lake wasn't frozen, I'd be going fishing today.
So there is still ice on the water.
Yeah, it got really cold here about 2 weeks ago, and I think, you know, I wouldn't want to get out on it right now, but it'll probably be gone here in a couple of days.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it was going to be 70 degrees today, so I could imagine, you know, if there was enough ice, you know, that might be the kind of weather that would tempt me into ice fishing. 70 degrees and sitting out on the bucket with a t-shirt.
I might fall through down here.
Well, why don't you put us on the map, Mike? Let us know kind of where you are.
Okay, I'm in northeast Kansas. I'm just on the northeast edge of the Flint Hills. And, you know, it's primarily quail country here, and there's prairie chickens here, not quite as many as you go farther west, but there are a few prairie chickens here and a lot of native grass, and it's pretty good quail ground, pretty good quail ground.
Yeah. Has that been a home base of yours for quite a while? You kind of Kansas, how long have you been in the Kansas area?
I've lived in Kansas since 2003, and I've lived in this particular area since 2012.
Okay.
And I'm retired now, and I spend my summers up in Montana, summers and fall in Montana, and then I spend, you know, winters and spring here in northeast Kansas. Kind of since I'm retired, I can go back and forth.
Well, that doesn't sound half bad.
No, I've been enjoying it.
Have you experimented with other areas, other places, like, because you're pretty mobile, it sounds like. Have you ever spent a winter somewhere else, or is it pretty much Montana, Kansas?
Yeah, last winter, I actually spent the winter in New Mexico, just south of Clovis, near Portales, and got into some scale quail hunting down there. And I actually was going to spend the winter down there, but it had been so warm. I went down there and visited earlier in November, and the rattlesnakes were just going to be out all winter. At least my rancher friend told me they were going to be out quite a bit. So. Oh. I'm kind of rattlesnake adverse, let's say. And so I decided I better get back to Kansas, and I spent the winter here instead. And it turned out really nice, except for the last, you know, end of January that was cold.
Have you ever had any, we'll get into this today, but you've been hunting and running bird dogs for a long, long time. Have you ever had any bad encounter or any encounters, I guess, with rattlesnakes?
Yeah, I've had a dog bit in Montana. And 3 years ago, I was walking back to my truck, and I just about stepped on one, and it about bit me. I had to one hand it with my shotgun and shoot it before it bit me.
Jeez.
Yeah. So I'm really rattlesnake adverse now. So I try to avoid even hunting when they're out. And it was almost the same exact date in September that my dog got bit, that I almost got bit. It was actually like the end of September, the 30th. And I think that they were going to den. They move around during the day going to den then. But that's the only two I've actually ever seen in Montana. Well, that's on the same day, just like that. So
yeah. Wow. What?
So that's kind of like I have a date. I try to avoid where there's snakes in Montana until the end of September.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that makes sense. That's typically when you hear about it, at least. What happened with the dog? Was it just sort of one of those things where snap your fingers and all of a sudden the dog's bit and you're wondering what's going on? Did you see it happen?
Well, it was cool. I was hunting farther west than I normally do. And we were hunting the edge of this wheat field with native grass on part of it. And we started out and it was in the 40s. It was cool. And we hunted till around 10:30 or 11. It was starting to warm up and we hadn't gotten any birds and we were heading back to the truck. And all my dogs are snake broke, and walked along. And all of a sudden, my old dog Jack, I could tell he was like, they'll point him, like they'll smell him from a great distance. And
okay.
I could tell he was pointing one. And then my other dog, Nate, he's a big runner. I mean, really big runner. And so he ran by and then he was pointing it too. So they were both pointing. And then I heard it rattling. I actually heard it then. It was probably about 15 or 20 yards in front of me off to the side. And then I saw Nate, he was holding up his back leg. and he had been bit. Mm. So apparently he had, you know, like I said, he runs hard. He must have just ran right by it, and it actually bit him on the bottom of his back foot as he ran by.
Wow. So not a front facing hit or anything.
No, I don't think, and there wasn't any wind, you know, and once their snake broke, you know, they can smell them and hear them and see them. You try to get them any three ways they should avoid them. And there's no way he could have smelled it or heard it, you know, and he must have just ran right by it and it bit him on the way by, you know. And so I took him down to a vet, and the vet, you know, was pretty much saw a lot of snake bites, and she was like, he'll probably be okay, and just gave him some antibiotics and we went on our way.
That was that.
Yeah. And he got sick for a couple of days. They have to metabolize the venom in their system. You know, his back leg swole up real bad, and he got real sick, couldn't hold his, you know, food down for a day or two. But after a couple of days, it was like he was just back to normal. Wow. It didn't really bother him that much.
Well, that's the good part, the recovery.
Yeah. So you know, I was more worried when I about stepped on one, because, you know, I'm not too worried of it being, you know, fatal. But I think what would have worried me is if I would have got bit, you know, I hunt by myself, and no doubt I probably would have had to go to the hospital for a few days.
Right.
And I wouldn't have had anybody to take care of my dog. So it's really more, I try to avoid me getting bit so I don't have to worry about my dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I guess I'm thinking, you know, you don't hear about people getting bit by snakes, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, do you... You know, I guess I can, the images that I'm conjuring up in my mind are like probably like scenes from a movie or something when somebody gets bit, and like maybe you get sort of like lethargic but like, what would you do? I mean, if you got bit, like you'd probably want to get into town quickly.
Well, to tell you the truth, this has been a few years ago, and Nate, I struggled with Nate really get him staunch on birds, and he had just had a great morning hunting some huns, and I'd killed a couple huns on him. So I was, you know, I was walking on air, so
sure,
to speak.
Sure.
I was so happy, so I really wasn't paying that much attention. We were walking back to the truck, and I looked down, and I'm like, oh, there's a rattlesnake. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's curling up, he's gonna bite me.
Oh.
And it was just like I had my shotgun in my right hand, and I shot him right there, right below my feet.
Wow.
Just right at me, getting ready to bite me. And so it kind of freaked me out a little bit, and it was like, you know, something you'd see in a western or something, you know.
Right. Did you save the tail or anything?
Pardon me?
Did you save the tail or anything?
I have a picture of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a pretty good sized rattlesnake. Yeah. And they're all prairie rattlers up in Montana. You know, they're not real poisonous, but they're still poisonous some. You know?
Okay. Yeah, that's unbelievable. So have you had your dogs go through, that sounded like you've maybe done the snake breaking? Like, do you do that yourself, or do you do clinics?
No, I had a trainer that lives out west of Lewistown that's he does snake breaking, and he usually has a clinic like right before the season starts, and he'll go through, you know, there'll be, you know, 40, 50 dogs there, and it's pretty simple, you know, simple thing. And I think it's very valuable. Obviously it's not 100% foolproof, but I also went back a year or two after I had all my dog snake broke. And you can test them, and what they'll do is they'll put he has a defanged snake, you know, so it can't really bite him.
Yep.
But it does bite him, but it doesn't have any teeth, you know, when you're breaking them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll put the snake out in the grass, and then you just let your dog free range around it and see how they react. And, you know, so all my dogs, you know, you put it downwind so they can smell it. Boy, as soon as they smell them, they're like, no, we're not going near that thing.
That's good.
You know?
Yeah.
But it was interesting. I have a female that she started smelling it, and she was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and actually started walking toward it.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, as soon as that snake rattled, it was like she had got shocked again. It was amazing.
Wow.
As soon as she heard it rattle, it was like she had got shocked, you know, full blast with the e-collar. And so she, you know, she obviously, the smelling part of it didn't work.
Yeah. She had forgot that part, but
yeah.
But the audio, but, yeah, yeah. She didn't forget that.
Yeah. And my old dog, Jack, he had been snake broke many years ago, and I actually tested him, and they can smell them from like 30 yards. If the wind's right, they can smell it from great distances.
Have you then seen, so yeah, it sounds like, I was going to ask you, it sounds like it's been successful. You don't go back and do it every year, but you can kind of do a little refresher
if
you
wanted to. Yeah, I just did it that one time, you know, and then that was before I almost stepped on one. And so, you know, now I don't really want to even hunt when there's, you know, a possibility of there being snakes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just try to avoid hunting, you know, until I think they've gone to the dens. And then,
There was something I was going to ask you. We talked snakes. Oh, all right. Let's circle back to Kansas. So your season just ended earlier this week. And I know you didn't hunt the last day, but, and we've had a little bit of weather, but it's been pretty mild. But were you getting some good hunts in into the new year a little bit in January up towards the end?
Yeah. It was a beautiful year this year here. It was really warm. It didn't snow or rain hardly much, a little bit, but not enough to really, you know, make you want to stay out of the fields. And the bird numbers were pretty good. And then that Arctic front that came through, I mean, it really shut everything down. I mean, shut the whole state down where I was at, you know, everything was shut down because it was really bad. And then I got out, it warmed back up the last 4 or 5 days of the season. And I got out and hunted 3 days. And I hunted the same ground. I normally will hunt the same covey of quail maybe 2 or 3 times a season and maybe kill a bird or two out of the covey each time. And so I went back and hunted some ground that I'd hunted previously in the season and did real well on. And I hunted 3 different covers, and I'd gotten into at least 5 coveys on those 3 covers. And when I hunted it after the cold front, I found 1 small covey in all 3 of them. And so they'd really, I think, had a tough time. I don't think they died from the cold because the habitat's really good, but I'd say the predators really, you know, really hit them hard because they were pretty wild. I couldn't get close to them.
What do you know about, because I know we chatted yesterday and you mentioned you kind of went to your one of your go-to quail resource books, which you should mention, but what do you know about winter survival? Like where do the quail retreat to? Where do they go? Is it heavy grass? Is it woody, shrubby cover? Where do they go when it's that cold?
Yeah, they go to the thickest cover they can find to stay out of the wind.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, I think that what that book it said that, you know, whenever there's a, you know, a severe weather, you know there's a die off, that the remaining birds will actually produce better because they have more abundant resources to, you know, make it through the winter on then the rest of the winter. You know, they don't have to, you know, like say you have enough food for 10 birds, but you only have 6 now. Well, see, they're going to be eating pretty good.
Right.
Because they've got enough food for 10. And so they'll come out of the winter in better breeding, you know, condition, and they'll have larger clutches of eggs and such.
Then. Kind of a rebound effect.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, I think there's enough remnant around that hopefully next year, you know, us bird hunters, we always hope for next year and good hatch.
Yeah.
So hopefully next year there'll be a good hatch here.
We're always reflecting on the season that just went by and then looking ahead to the next one. And with that, sometimes you can lose sight of sort of the longer history or perspective of sort of what we're dealing with, those ebbs and flows. What with quail, like, I guess my understanding of them is that they are, like a lot of upland birds, they really can ebb and flow. There can be real significant highs and lows. In the area that you are, just in general, like, what is the kind of your overall sense of quail? Like, is it a pretty healthy population that's pretty viable to hunt and find birds each year? Or are there some years that are real lean? Like, because you were kind of mentioning to me that you're on kind of the edge of sort of the northern bobwhite territory. So I'm just wondering, like, if they're really on the fringe of their range, like what that looks like from a consistency perspective, if that makes any sense.
Well, the bobwhite, northern bobwhite, you know, is distributed, you know, all the way from here down into Mexico. And, you know, when you get down in the desert areas, you know, in Texas and New Mexico and Arizona, there's actually other species down there. But the bobwhite down in the areas, in the desert areas, they're really dependent on the rain, you know, because it's a desert, it's dry. And so they're, their numbers can fluctuate wildly with the rains. You know, if they don't get the rains, they may not have a hatch at all. Where I'm at here in Northeast Kansas, you know, that we get over 40 inches of rain a year. So it's, you know, there's quite a bit of rain, and the problem where I'm at here is not the drought. It's more too wet and cool of a spring.
Okay.
And they won't make it. They won't have a good hatch because it's been too moist. And so this year, by agricultural standards, this area here was in a drought because they got half their normal rain. But half their normal rain here is 20 inches. Mm. So it may not have been a good year for crops, but it was a pretty good year for quail.
Native game birds are doing all right with 20 inches.
Yeah. So, you know, so when you look at, you know, if you're looking to come to Kansas or really anywhere, you know, where they're dependent on the moisture or too much moisture, as in this case, you know, you might look at the drought monitor and, oh my gosh, they're in a drought. There's not going to be any birds. Well, that may or may not be true, you know, because like a drought out in western Kansas where they get 20 inches of rain, well, they may have only got 10, you know.
Yeah.
Well, drought here, you're still getting 20 inches of rain and they'll still have a good hatch.
Do you have a favorite bird? I mean, are quail kind of your favorite bird? It sounds like you get around and chase different birds, but do they sort of stand out for you?
Yeah, quail, bobwhite quail are my favorite bird to hunt by far. They're very tasty for one thing, and they're good for the dogs. You know, they hold well. And where I've always hunted here in the Midwest, you know, you're going to have birds, you know, because they're just, the habitat usually is pretty good, and you're reliably going to have some rain. And one of the things that they've been recently doing some studies over in Missouri, Southwest Missouri, they radio collared a bunch of hens. And they did some studies on the hatch, where normally, you know, when they study quail, they'll radio collar them during the hunting season to see, you know, how many of them are killed by hunters. So this was kind of a unique study where they radio collared them during the hatch. And it was an amazing study because they found out a lot of the places that the quail liked to nest weren't the places that they thought they did. Mm. And, you know, it's been I don't know if I'm going to call it a law, but a principle that, you know, the peak of the quail hatch was the beginning of June. I mean, that was just, everybody believed that.
Okay.
Well, they found out that actually the peak is in August, much later than what they thought, because all the late nesters and the re-nesters. And so there'll be a peak, you know, of the first nesters that'll pull off a hatch in June. And then there'll be actually a bigger hatch, according to their studies that they did of the radio collar birds, in August. So, you know, they're in this area here, you know, you're usually going to have some birds, you know, if the habitat's good, you know, there'll be some birds here. There won't be birds like you're going to find maybe down in Texas, you know, where you're going to run into 20 or 30 coveys a day during good years. But here, you know, you might, a good day here, I would say if you run into 4 or 5 coveys a day, that's a good year.
When does the season get started? Is it October?
It starts in Missouri, which that's where I first started hunting. It opens November 1st. And then I think that Nebraska, which actually has some pretty good quail numbers, it opens last Saturday of October, I believe.
Okay.
And then here in Kansas, it opens the second Saturday in November. It opens quite a bit later here.
Okay. Yeah. That just makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in Iowa, there's some pretty good quail hunting in southern Iowa, and it opens the last Saturday in October too.
Right. Okay. Yep. That is a bird I have yet to, I've not hunted wild quail. I need to do that.
They're a really neat bird to hunt. They're good for the dogs. They're tough to shoot. You know, I mean, especially here around where I hunt and have hunted in Missouri, because, you know, there's still a lot of timber. And so it's sometimes, if you hunt by yourself, for sure, it's similar to hunting and shooting rough grouse in the timber, you know, because they're going to stay in that timber. They're not going to get out of it.
And they'll flush out the other side of the bush.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. They'll keep everything between you and themselves, you know, to get away from you. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, this year, I hunt by myself and many times a lot of really good dog work, but not very many shots.
Yeah, that's a common topic of conversation amongst myself and some of the grouse, just as you say, grouse hunt. I mean, the difference between one dog and one shooter versus one dog and two shooters, you know, both are enjoyable. Like you said, I mean, there's not many more things that I enjoy than following just me and one of my dogs going through the grouse woods. Just that I can wander anywhere. I'm not paying attention to anything but the dog, but you will inevitably get some of those frustrating moments where you think to yourself, geez, if I only had a buddy standing on the other side of the spruce tree there.
I think the other thing about hunting bobwhite quail is I think the coveys are fairly easy to find for any, you know, like you could bring a dog, you know, a grouse dog down here and they'll find the coveys because, you know, you're talking about 10, 12 birds are putting off quite a bit of sand.
Sure.
But hunting the singles for dogs that haven't hunted wild quail before, it's quite a challenge because, you know, they don't put off, one bird does not put off a whole lot of scent. And I've had, you know, grouse hunting friends come down and they've got good dogs, good grouse dogs, no doubt. And my dogs will be pointing singles and their dogs will just be running around like, what's he pointing? Because it takes a while to adjust to the, you know, it's kind of a, you know, and I think that's why the birds survive a lot is because even good dogs won't find all the singles, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's a survival mechanism, right? The covey breaks up and they scatter and then they reconnect. What's your, so now if this dips into ethics and stuff, I'd be curious, but like, what is your, you break up a covey, do you shoot the covey rise? And then you sounds like you follow up singles, but what's your sort of ethos as far as how you approach hunting a covey and breaking one up and hunting singles?
Well, you know, there's some debate there a little bit between quail hunters. I've hunted down in Texas on some leases down there, and down there, the lease I hunted on, you couldn't hunt singles. You just shot
only the covey rise.
And then moved on. Of course, you know, you'd get into 20 coveys a day.
Yeah.
You know, so, but then another thought is that a lot of times if you shoot it at the covey, you might hit birds that you don't knock down and they're going to die later, that you don't kill them. So some people won't shoot on a covey rise. They'll just shoot singles because then you make sure you don't wound any other birds. Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of in the middle there. I'll shoot on a covey rise. I mean, once you get used to, you know, when you first start quail hunting, there's no doubt you're going to blast at a covey and not hit anything because you're just covey shooting, you know. And I think that's normal, you know.
It was normal in my, I mean, I don't have a lot of experience shooting covey birds, but it's, I've got a ways to go as far as keeping my head straight.
Yeah. I mean, you see, you know, 15 birds get up and you just shoot at them and none of them drop and you're like,
what?
How come I could be hitting those birds, you know?
Yep.
And you may have, that's the deal. You may have, and you just didn't hit a wing,
right?
You know, or something like that. But, you know, when I hunt anymore, when a covey gets up, I'm real patient. You know, I wait to see if there, you know, usually there's one or two that's going to go a different direction or, you know, flare off or a straggler, you know? And so on a covey rise, you know, I might pick a bird off if I make sure I'm not going to, you know, shoot into the covey or something. But the real thing is hunting singles. I think that way, you know, for sure whether you hit the bird or not. And it's more of a challenge for your dog, you know?
Yeah.
And it's easier for you shooting singles. I mean, you know, when you're, you know, when you bust up a covey and then you know where they go and your dog's over there and he comes down on point, you know, there's going to be a bird there.
Right.
And so you can walk in and flush it and usually you get a pretty good shot.
Yeah. Yeah. You could absolutely see the fun and the anticipation in that. And
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So you've been doing this for quite a while. I've mentioned that, but take me back to the start, Mike. I'm always curious how people find their way into upland bird hunting. I mean, what hooked you and, you know, first birds, first shotguns, like give me some of the, some of the beginning, the origin story.
Well, I've been a hunter for a long time. I started, you know, small game hunting when I was like 10 years old. You know, I'll be 65 in May. So I've been hunting a long time.
Hey, you retired early.
Yeah.
Congrats. And,
well, I had to bird hunt. So
good for you.
Anyway, you know, I've been small. I was a small game hunter for a long time. And when I grew up hunting, there was no big game. There were no deer and turkeys hardly. It was all small game, you know, squirrels, rabbits, occasional, you know, I might flush a covey of quail every now and then and shoot one, but I didn't have bird dogs or anything. And so, you know, I went to college and I still small game hunted. And when I got out of college, I was living in Sedalia, Missouri. I was working for a utility company there, and church I was going to, one of the guys there, he was a bird hunter, and he invited me to go bird hunting with him. I was early 20s. And so we went out, and I remember to this day, I could pinpoint it on Google Map exactly where it was. He had some Brittany's, and this Brittany came down on point on this pile of brush. And my friend goes, "Go in there and flush that covey." And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "That dog's on point. There's a covey of birds there." And I'm like, "What? Okay." So I walked in there, and sure enough, covey got up. Of course, I didn't hit anything, you know.
You shot, though.
But you know, from that moment on, it was like, that was just magic. Yeah. It was like, that was just magic. And so, you know, I don't know. It's still magic. I don't know what else to say. You know, when the dog's pointing a bird, it's just magical to me. And it's causing me to retire early and do all kinds of things, I think, you know, that magic.
So did that make you a Brittany man for life?
It did. That spring, I hunted with him all winter. That first winter I hunted, and that spring I got my first Brittany, and he was a great dog. His name was Jake. And I hunted with him, and many people were like, you know, "That's a good dog. You ought to breed him." So I got a female, and I had a few litters of pups with them. And then, you know, he passed on, and I had two of his sons I kept with me that I hunted till they were like, I think they were 12 and 13. And I was like, man, I need to start looking for a dog, you know? And so I saw an ad in the paper, and I got a French Brittany then, from this breeder west Topeka in the Flint Hills, and his name's Jack. And Jack's been my bird dog of a lifetime. He's just a tremendous dog. He's 14 now, and he'll be 15 in April. So I've got some pups out of him. He was a good dog, and I got some pups out of him. And so, yeah, I've been kind of a Brittany guy, and probably always will be, I would think, you know.
What do you remember about going back to your first dog? I mean, what do you remember about... You know, was there training? And I mean, did you just basically take them and hunt them, and like any sort of funny stories of like things you think back on and just laugh about?
Well, when I first started quail hunting, it was quail hunting in Missouri, West Central Missouri. And all my friends had Brittany's that I hunted with. And, you know, I didn't know what to do. I'm like, well, what do I need to train him? And every one of my Brittany friends would tell me, you just need to do obedience training, you know, get him to come and stay. And they're all, and if it's a good dog, it'll just naturally, it's bred to hunt birds, and it'll hunt. And every Brittany that I've ever had, I that's all I do. I just teach them the obedience training, you know, and they figure it out eventually, you know, that, you know, they all point hold birds, and they back and they retrieve. You know, I've never had one that didn't do that.
So you're a fairly hands-off, well, hands-off maybe not the right word, but sort of do the obedience training and then just let them develop bird contact and hunting.
But I think, you know, to be quite honest with you, it may be harder to do that now because there just aren't the same number of wild birds as there was,
right?
You know, I've had access to through my hunting, you know, experiences, because most of the places that I've lived, I've been able to like walk out my front door and get into quail.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could take my puppies out and they'd be getting into wild birds, you know, the first year they hunted, you know, right away, and, you know, had home coveys where I didn't shoot very many of them, and, you know, was able to work my dogs on them and such.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. That may not, you know, be true for a lot of folks, especially folks that like live out east, you know, that there just aren't very many wild birds. You know, I don't know if you can still do that there. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely a critical component to that method. You got to have the birds to let the birds teach the dog, if you will.
Yeah.
Did you ever go as far as, you know, did you have a pigeon coop or anything like that? Or you pretty much just relied on wild birds?
No, just wild birds. That's it. None of my dogs have ever seen any pen raised birds at all, ever. Well, I shouldn't say that. I did try. I did one time. I'm like, well, let's just see what my dogs will do. So I bought some quail, you know, and I put them down. They wouldn't even point them. They'd just pick them up and bring them to me.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and I think it was because they knew they I don't know if they had a human smell on them.
Yeah.
They just didn't, they smelled like they were injured, you know, and so they just hunted them like they were dead birds, you know, like, you know, you tell a dog to hunt dead, you know, they would just go over and they might point them for an instant and then they just pick them up, bring them to me.
Yeah.
So I've never thought that would be a good thing to do with my dogs, you know, and that may just be particular to my dogs and me, you know.
So it sounds like, what about like steadiness training? I mean, it doesn't sound like you've got into a whole lot of that, you know, stop to flush and, you know, that kind of, you're just kind of, you're hunting your dogs and they're at least steady to flush and backing and pretty natural.
I did when Jack was younger, I did break him and I field trialed him three or four times.
Okay.
And I got a title on him, but I didn't keep him broke, you know, completely broke. He's, you know, all my dogs, they're steady to the flush.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that's the only one I have had though. I have one now. I've seen two of my dogs are actually naturally broke to the flush. They would actually, they would not break on the flush. They
Interesting.
Would be staunched. Yeah. And I didn't do it. And then anything I did, they were just naturally like that.
Yeah.
You know, they won't release until I tell them to. And so I don't know what happened.
Well, that's pretty natural. I mean, I wouldn't complain if my dogs did that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got pictures of, you know, there's kind of a, you know, bird hunters talk about the progression you go through as you go through your bird hunting experiences, you know, and you first start out, you just want to kill a bird and then you might want to kill a limit or something. And then as you get farther along, it's, well, I'm going to make it more difficult or challenging, or I'm only going to shoot this, or I'm only going to do that. And so I'm at that point in my bird hunting career. I don't really kill very many birds, but my goal is, you know, like my dog's on point. I'll want to walk up, take a picture. I try to get a picture of every bird I kill with my dog on point.
Mm-hmm.
And then cool. I'll shoot the bird and then I'll get my camera back out and I'll take a picture of him retrieving the bird. So that's kind of like my extreme, you know, way I like to hunt.
Yeah. The evolution of your bird hunting.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I actually have some pictures of my dogs where the birds are flushing and they're still staunch. They're not chasing at all. And I didn't do that. It's just natural.
Yeah.
I do it naturally. So
that's cool.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think maybe I've just been lucky and blessed at the same time. Maybe, you know?
Well, it could be both. Yeah. They're I love those pictures. You know, my dogs, it's funny, my dogs don't really bring them back to me, and I've never force fetched them or anything. My younger setter, she'll pick grouse up and she likes to prance around with them, and I do try to get pictures. But some of my other friends that have more versatile dogs or just better retrievers, they get these, you know, awesome pictures of their dogs coming back to them with the bird's wing over the nose. I love that stuff. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, personally, I think that, you know, having a dead bird dog is much more important than the dog that, you know, retrieves the hand. You know, I mean, you'd really want to have both.
Right, right.
But if you have a dog that will hunt dead for you and find dead birds, that's very valuable, especially for quail, you know, when you hunt wild quail.
I can imagine, yeah.
Man, they're tough to find. They're really hard to find, you know, if you don't have a dog.
Especially, you know, like in grass, you know, I mean, heavy grass, like that's, man, you start looking for a bird in grass and it's always eye-opening for me when I'm looking around for birds in the woods. You know, that's challenging in a way, but it's not like they're not getting swallowed up in heavy grass, like a small hun or a quail is.
Yeah. Yeah. And quail are so small, you know, that they're in there and they blend right in.
Right.
You know, I've gone up before when my dog's been on point and I'll sit there and just to look to see if I can see the birds. And I've only seen maybe in my many years of quail hunting, maybe one or two cubbies on the ground that I actually could see before they flushed. They're just so hard to see. They just blend in so well that you can't see them, you know. And then once you do see them, it's amazing that as soon as you make eye contact, like they know once you see them.
Flush.
Even though you don't move, just making eye contact with them is enough that they'll flush.
Yeah. Yeah. I would imagine a lot of listeners would kind of, you have that experience where you make eye contact with that animal, like there's this moment of tension, and you know, a lot of it's probably in your own mind and body, but there's something to that. I mean, it's real. Yeah. Because you've seen them take off and flush enough after you do lock eyes with a bird or a deer or anything like that. You know, there's a sense there.
I've only did that just a few times though, because they normally you can't see them.
Yeah.
You know, they're just so well camouflaged.
Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and Fred of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Jack. Let's talk about Jack. This is something that I've been interested in. Just, you know, you've had dogs over the years. You've been doing it for a long time. Some dogs just kind of rise to the top. And what makes Jack so special, you know, over his 14, 15 years? What's kind of made him your dog of a lifetime?
Well, you know, when I got Jack, he's my first French Brittany. And it's hard to explain. It just, you know, there's almost like we have a spiritual connection. Mm. And from the very get-go, I got him in August, right before I made my first trip to Montana.
Was he an 8-week old pup?
He actually was 4 months old when I got him.
Okay.
And so he was 4 months old and I got him like a week or two before I headed to Montana. And I hadn't did any work with him at all. No obedience training, nothing, you know, maybe a little bit, obviously, you know, in that week or so, but you know, not much. And I still had three American Brittany's that I was hunting with and my two older guys. And I had a younger female that I had too. And so I headed to Montana, and the first night I was there, I stayed at this motel, you know, little motel in this little town. And the next morning, you know, I let the dogs out. They were in the truck. I let the dogs out, you know, to go to, you know, you go pee.
Yeah.
And Jack, I let him out, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't even know if he'll come back to me. I hadn't done any work with him, you know? And so we're, you know, in this little town, and he went across the parking lot, and he did his duty. And I called him. I don't think he even really knew his name hardly. And I called him, and he came right back to me. And I don't know, there was just something about our relationship from the very get go that he's just been, you know, his skills are great. He's loyal. He's the best dog. Even if he wasn't the best bird dog I'd ever had, he's the best dog, all around dog I think I've ever had. And I've had a lot of dogs, you know, I've had different kinds of dogs and stuff. So
yeah.
He's special. He's still hunting at 14, and I don't know, he may outlast me, but he's hunted all kinds of birds. I've killed sage grouse, sharp tail, prairie chickens, you know, quail, different kinds of quail. Rough grouse, blue grouse, turkeys. I've killed turkeys over them in Kansas.
No kidding.
Yeah, not you can't anymore. I don't think you can even fall hunt turkeys anymore because the numbers are so down here now. But back when the turkey numbers were good here, they consider them upland birds. And in Kansas, you can actually hunt them with dogs in the fall. And so I've killed pointed turkeys over him, which is a blast.
I would love to do. I've heard of that happening. I know folks that have had, you know, their dogs point them, but man, to shoot a turkey over a bird dog, that would be unreal.
It's pretty intense, and there's a technique to it. You know when you spring turkey hunt, you know, you want to shoot them in the head, you know, with when you want to shoot a flush turkey, you actually want to shoot them under their wing, because that's their vitals are most vulnerable under their wing.
Oh, there's wow.
No, you know, because, you know, it's all just skin. There's no ribs or anything hardly there. So you want to time your shot to where their wings are, you know, extended, and shoot them under the wing. Yeah, I've killed probably maybe half a dozen pointed turkeys.
Jeez. You know, I've started hunting them now, and obviously I'm only doing the spring hunting, which is totally different, but I've only been around a few turkeys flushing, you know, just to even get eyes on a bird flushing. Last year when I was hunting by myself, I was walking and I flushed a bird that I think might have been a tom. I was walking down a trail and calling, and in hindsight, he may have been coming to look at me, but I'm still figuring out, like, I don't really know what I'm doing out there, but I've had a little bit of success. But I was walking along, and you know, when I'm grouse hunting, I'm usually very ready, but when I'm turkey hunting, I'm not. I got my gun on a sling, and you know, it's just not really what I'm out there to do. But this was one of the first or instances where I flushed this bird, and he flew straight away from me for a long ways. Now, I couldn't tell 100% that it was a tom, so I probably never would have shot, but I just remember thinking, I mean, I had a really good shot at this bird. It just was it kind of stopped me, and I was thinking about it. And man, if you had a dog on point, that would be next level.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably the coolest bird I killed over Jack was a sage grouse. I've only killed one sage grouse in Montana. And this was probably 12 years ago. You know, everybody that goes to Montana, you know, I want to kill a sage grouse before they list them or something, you know, which will probably happen one day. But anyway, you know, I would always make a couple days out on my trip there to try to kill a sage grouse. And sage grouse country is really rough ground, you know, cactus and rocks and rattlesnakes and such. And so I'd usually try for a couple days to kill a sage grouse. And so the first 2 years I went to Montana, we hunted for sage grouse, and I didn't find any, didn't see any of them. And so I went out this one morning and had three dogs down, Jack and Jack's full brother D, and then one of my old American Brits, my old female, and I was hunting three dogs down, and we had it all morning, and it was starting to get hot, you know, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, snakes, you know. And so it was about 10:30, and we were headed back to the truck, and all of a sudden Jack came down on point, And I let my dog naturally relocate on their own, you know, on running birds. And so Jack started pointing and relocating like he was trailing a pheasant, you know, like you'd pheasant hunt. That's what it looked like to me. And I don't think there's any pheasants out here, and pheasant season wasn't open anyway. Anyway, he pointed and relocated, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times. And so he went over this little ridge, and when I came over, man, he was locked up solid. And I walked down there and I flushed two gigantic sage grouse, two bombers, big ones. And I missed on the first shot, and then I hit one on the second. And that's the sage grouse I killed over. But that was probably I would think the only trophy bird I would say that I killed over, you know, and it weighed 7 pounds. It was a big one.
Jeez, that's unreal.
Yeah, it was huge. Yeah, I've got pictures of them. It's just really, and that's the only sage grouse I've ever killed in Montana, because I just don't like to hunt that rough ground.
Yeah. Yep. I've done that a little bit, hunted sage grouse one time, and I did kill one. It was not a bomber. I actually passed up a shot at a bomber that, in hindsight, I don't think I should have. My dog was pointing, but I was sort of conflicted as to the dog work. And there was some additional commotion going on there, so I didn't shoot that. But I did kill one, and definitely appreciated seeing the birds and seeing the habitat. I haven't made any plans to go back or do it again. But back to the turkey for a minute. Like, what kind of setup, like, because I always wonder what would make a turkey hold. Because where I'm hunting in the grouse woods, we do have turkeys now. I mean, I see their tracks, and there are some areas that I grouse hunt where there's a decent amount of turkeys. But I have yet to have one time one of my dogs kind of wild flushed one where all of a sudden I looked up and this bird was coming over me. But I imagine them running. You know, I'm coming through with my dog's got bells on, and I imagine the turkeys aren't hanging around to see what we're doing, but there have been times where we've got a pointing and moving and nothing produces. And I sometimes will wonder, like, geez, was that a turkey? Like, what makes a turkey hold?
Well, all the ones that I've killed have been in tall grass CRP.
Okay.
You know, where they're holding tight in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're kind of surprised at first, you know, because you're expecting like a pheasant, you know,
but a tenth the size.
Yeah. And so, you know, the first time that happens, you know, you'll usually miss because you're just like, oh my gosh, you know. But then, you know, once you get used to that, the possibility and like I said, the turkey numbers used to be really tremendous around here where I'm at in the northeast corner. And so, you know, back then you could actually kill four turkeys in the fall, and you could buy four tags. And so I always bought two tags and kept them with me just in case. And, and I usually would kill one a year or so, sometimes two. I killed two one year, but yeah, it's a lot of fun. But the bad thing about it is if you're way away far from the truck and all the turkeys that I killed on points, they were all big. They were like 20 pounders. And carrying a 20-pound bird back to the truck from like a couple miles away, that's not a whole lot of fun, you know.
Well, you got to get a Final Rise vest, Mike.
Yeah, probably should. But the turkey numbers are really bad. And I think they're bad really across a lot of the country anymore. And so I don't even know if they have a fall turkey season here in Kansas anymore. I think they eliminated it because the numbers are so low now.
Yeah. You know? That is, I will admit, it's just, I'm not educated on that, but I am aware of the sentiment and turkey numbers being going down in the South. And I find it so, I guess, maybe ironic or interesting because we're having the exact opposite thing here where turkeys have just expanded into an area that I've been hunting my whole life and we never had them. And now we do. And I have this opportunity. So it's really, I don't know, it's interesting.
Well, I think what it is, and you guys are probably going to go through it there just a little later on, it's just a natural predator and prey relationship. And so I noticed in the spring when I first started hunting, you know, around here, you know, 12 years ago when the numbers were really good, that, you know, the turkeys would gobble all the time and they'd gobble on the ground. You could hear them gobbling all day long, you know, and then slowly, pretty soon, the only time they'd gobble would be on the roost. And the last year or two I spring hunted, I was hunting and I got in and I got set up probably about 50 or 60 yards away from a bunch of roosted ones, and they were gobbling, and I thought for sure they were, I was going to get, call them over. And there was a bunch of jakes there too. And when the jakes started flying down, a bobcat was right on them. I mean, right on them.
Wow.
As soon as they hit the ground, a bobcat got them. And so I think that
you saw
the predator,
it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the predators eventually figured out, you know, they hear something gobbling. That's dinner. It's dinner time. And so I think the predators finally figured them out. And I think the snakes figure out eating the eggs, and they're starting to, the predators are just figuring them out. And so it'll ebb and flow.
Yeah.
You know, there's still the turkeys, but I think the peak number of turkeys here in Kansas and areas like this, they'll never be like they were like that.
Again, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Some of the gobbling studies that they've done too, I've listened to some podcasts, and where they get a lot of hunting pressure, like they can pretty much see the turkeys will quiet down, and they just start gobbling less, which, I mean, that'll, if you think about it from a natural selection perspective, you know, a bird has a tendency to be more vocal is likely to be killed, and he's not passing his genes on. And I mean, some of that in.
About the same time, you know, I'd be calling, and I'd call coyotes in with the turkey.
Yeah.
So they were keen on the hens. And so I think the predator just figured them out. It takes them a while to do that. So, you know, it'll probably happen to you guys too eventually.
Probably. Well, I'm kind of curious because this year I got a tag in Wisconsin, and Minnesota's over the counter. So I will have some turkey hunting ahead. And up to this point now, as far as winter survival goes, I would say it's been a very easy winter for turkeys because the snow depth is about zero. And we, apart from that one cold snap, which obviously if they're here now, they can survive some cold weather. But I think this has been a pretty good winter for deer and turkeys to this point. So I'm kind of curious if I see some sort of an uptick this spring. I don't, time will tell, but you mentioned to me yesterday that you did live in Maine and you mentioned grouse. So I know you've done some grouse hunting. How long were you up there? How much grouse hunting have you done?
Well, I lived in Maine for a year and actually traveled to Montana that year.
Couldn't stay away.
I hunted Montana and Kansas. I'm not a big rough grouse hunter.
Okay.
But I did hunt Vermont that year and killed my first rough grouse that year in Vermont. And I think Maine, I was there, the first year I retired, I've been traveling around, and I spent the early part of May in northern Maine, and I was camped back on some paper ground, you know, timber ground, you know, near the Golden Road, so to speak. And I'd never heard rough grouse, you know, drum before ever. And I was at this one spot where I was camped, and there were literally grouse drumming in every direction around me. It was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard.
Yeah.
It was really neat. But I'm a prairie hunter. I like to hunt out in the open, but I've grouse hunted in Vermont. I've grouse hunted in Minnesota. And I've killed grouse in Montana. I've killed a blue grouse and rough grouse in Montana.
Okay.
But I like to be out in the open. I like to see my dogs and I have to tell you, to be quite honest with you, I think rough grouse hunting is tough. That's tough hunting. You know, it's tough shooting for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's tough because, you know, I think they run a lot more than you think they do.
They definitely run. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But I didn't kill any grouse in Minnesota. The birds have been pressured, and so it was tough to get close to them. You know.
Yeah.
But we saw quite a few.
How long ago was that?
Oh, it's probably been 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I certainly understand. I mean, when I get the chance to hunt open country and watch my dogs, I mean, I'm not complaining. I can tell you that. I love that as well. Anytime you can see your dogs work.
Yeah. Yeah. When one interesting thing is, like, years ago when I first started quail hunting in Missouri, you know, Missouri actually gets a pretty good flight of woodcock.
Okay.
You know, and when we used to quail hunt, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with woodcock now, but like when we used to quail hunt and our dogs would point a woodcock, we would yell out woodcock like they were a hen pheasant. Don't shoot it. Because we didn't want to shoot it, you know, because we had quail, you know, and the quail are much better.
Sure.
But
what about now? Well, what about now? Like, do you hunt any areas where you've got woodcock coming through?
Well, actually, I've had some woodcock, Jack's pointed woodcock here where I'm at in Kansas.
That's kind of what I was curious. Okay.
Yeah. Not very many, maybe three or four.
Can you shoot them? I mean, do they have a season or what would be the?
Yeah. They have a season here.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't shoot them, but in Missouri where I lived at one time, I got into a flight of them there and like killed my limit of woodcock in like 15 minutes one time there in Missouri, just cause it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, but they have a pretty good flight that goes through, you know, the western Missouri for sure, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting to just the habitat that they move through and where folks see them along the way, you know, on their journey south and north.
Yeah, I think that, you know, now that the quail numbers in Missouri aren't nearly what they were years ago, I think that a lot of the bird hunters there have kind of adapted to woodcock.
A little more attention on woodcock.
Yeah. I know some hunters that actually, you know, I would consider them to be woodcock hunters, actually.
Well, it's like when you got bird dogs, you kind of want to see them get on birds. So you do what you got to do.
Yeah.
So I am curious, too, given that you've been doing this a long time, you obviously have been bird hunting. I know you weren't listening to podcasts when you had your first bird dog, and there was no Onyx hunt. There was no GPS collars. I'm kind of curious what sort of technology you have adapted to and sort of utilized. I don't know if you even need to run GPS collars on your dog, but do you use any of that stuff?
Well, I'm kind of old school. I actually didn't even use training collars till about 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I've got some training collars and I'm not good with them. Let's say, you know, when you stimulate them, you know, give them a little electric shock. Well, you know, I'd have a couple dogs down and I have Garmin, you know, where you can toggle them back and forth, you know, one dog to the other. And so I've used them on my younger dogs. I never used them on Jack. And so, you know, I'd want to correct a dog, you know, and I'd give them a little light stimulus and it wouldn't do anything. I'm like, okay. See, so I'd crank it up a little bit more, give them a bit more, and it wouldn't do anything. So I'd like give them the shock, and it wouldn't do anything. Well, I'm shocking the wrong dog.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
You know, I had it on the wrong dog. And so I just never was able to adapt to using the e-collar portion of the training collars. But so I actually took the electrodes off. I don't even have them on my collars anymore because my poor dog was getting shocked. They didn't know what was going on anyway, but I do use them now and I like them for the tone.
Yep.
You know, I use tone for recall and I use vibrate for stay.
Okay. So interesting.
I do like them for that. And so that's probably the extent of my technology right there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I say, wow, in that you hadn't been using them, but to be honest, I use mine in a very similar way that you do. I pretty much only use vibrate, and that's kind of I've heard trainers say, you don't really want to do that, but you know, everybody kind of finds their own way. I use vibrate as like if I were in the woods, which is likely, I can't see my dogs, but I kind of want them to check in, I'll hit the vibrate. I don't use tone that way, but it's the same idea. Yeah. And I mean, the number of times that I think when I first got my dog, you know, e-collars were a thing, and I kind of felt like, oh, you get a hunting dog, you got to have an e-collar. So, like, I bought them right away, and I kind of tried to figure them out. But the longer it's been now, I feel like the less I actually use. I'm only using the GPS and then the vibrate feature, I mean, 99% of the time. I do know how to use the stimulation, and I have, you know, I have that in my back pocket. But to your point, like, the amount of times I actually feel I need to use that for my dogs is very, very low.
Well, now don't get me wrong. I think that they, for the folks that know how to use them,
right.
Or if I was a grouse hunter where, you know, I wasn't able to see my dogs, you know, I would definitely want to, you know, have GPS and, and, you know, if I, if I, if I was technologically advanced enough to know how to toggle a back and forth and not shock the wrong dog, you know, I can see that's a very valuable training tool, no doubt. I mean, it's not that I don't, you know, see the technological advantage of it. It's just that, you know, I'm so far down on the learning curve with how I've always handled my dogs that, you know, I'm an old dog and I can't learn new tricks, I guess. You know, I don't know what else to say.
But I think that, I mean, I do think that's, again, I think it's a good, it's something to hit on, just because I think a lot of people get a hunting dog and sort of assume they need a collar, and again, myself included, but I mean, the quality of dogs, like a dog that is biddable and can develop naturally. I mean, the amount that you need to use that collar is probably a lot less than a lot of people might think when you're just, when you're just getting into it. So I think that's
exactly,
good, you know,
And I think there's no substitute for backyard training for obedience. I think that, that you have to, you need to have that, you know, voice and maybe whistle, you know, recall. I mean, cause what if your battery's dead, or what if, you know, whatever happens that you need. So I think you need to have that foundation, and then you can build the training collar on top of that, you know?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And again, like, you know, if you feel like you don't know exactly what you're doing, how to use it, you know, best to just put that tool away. You know, don't use something that you don't know how to use, or use it right, and go back to basics, like you said. That's more important.
I felt so sorry for my dogs, because, you know, I'd be trying to correct them, and they'd be like, that dog's just blowing me off, and I'd crank it up and zap them. And I know my other dog would be yipping because he'd be getting sad. And so I'm like, you know, this isn't beneficial for me, you know, but I'm not saying it isn't beneficial for someone that starts out using it. You know what I mean?
No, there's plenty of
video games. I don't play video games either.
You never played Bird Hunter Wild Wings Edition?
No. I haven't played any video games. That's just way beyond my time. You know?
I grew up in a little different era, obviously, and have played my fair share of video games. But even now, like at this point in life, sometimes I think I want to, but I don't really have the time to do it. So I rarely do. I've got more important things to do.
I think I did play a little Pong or something.
Oh yeah, there you go. Love it. What was the, I don't know if we mentioned it, but what was the name of that quail book that you mentioned?
It's called On Bob White. Okay. It's by Guthrie.
Guthrie.
Yeah.
Okay. I was talking a lot about books recently, and I always get listeners asking about book recommendations and sort of lists and stuff. So I like to highlight that. Do you have a big library of Upland books? Do you read a lot of that stuff?
I do read a lot. I usually will check them out from the library, or I give them away. So I really don't keep them, you know, I kind of funnel them around, but that's a good one. Guthrie is a scientist. He's, you know, he's from Oklahoma State, I believe. And so all of his stuff is scientifically based, you know, like a lot of the stuff that they'll do, like, for example, you know, they talked about how, you know, fire ants were killing the quail.
Mm-hmm.
You
know, I've heard that.
Well, he's got a deal in there, you know, a study in there where they'll have two separate groups of quail. And most of his research has been done like in Texas, you know, or southeast, you know, tall timbers and so forth. And so they had two different groups of quail, and on one of the groups, they killed all the fire ants. I mean, they went in there and just, they killed them all. And so on the other group, there were fire ants there. And so they would do the research, and they found out there wasn't any difference in the number of birds. It didn't make any difference whether fire ants or not. And they'll have another where they'll have like guzzlers, waterers for them, and then the other ones they won't. And they found out, no, that doesn't make any. And so it's a very scientific study of Bob White quail. And it's mainly done Texas ranchers that are wanting to make money off their quail, basically. So the studies are to show them how to manage the ranches down there for quail, basically, for wild quail.
Okay. What about any other, do you have any other favorite books or anything, any recommendations?
Yeah, I had one. But I can't remember it now. See, I'm getting really old. Can't even remember.
Did you ever read Call of the Quail? Does that ring a bell?
No.
I've got a copy here. It's in plastic wrap. I bought it used, but yeah, Country Sport Press. They did all these anthologies. There's one on grouse, one on woodcock, and I was getting recommendations from people last year, and I think I got a pretty good price on this one. You can't hardly find the grouse and woodcock ones, but I know I found the quail one. Haven't read it, but if it's anything like the other ones, there's also one called A Breed Apart, which is that's all about dogs. But same Country Sport Press, and that's just I just love that stuff, and especially this time of year, it's good reading. So I gotta crack open that quail one.
I'll tell you an author, I can't remember the name of his book, but his name's Joel Bance.
Okay.
And he worked for the Missouri Department of Conservation, and I think more of a writer than any type of biology work. But he has some books out on quail hunting in Missouri, and I can't remember the titles of them, but the author's named Joel Bance, and any book by him on quail, because he's a quail hunter. And I think there's one book he wrote that kind of highlights his, you know, history of quail hunting in Missouri and how it went downhill and why it went downhill and the causes of it and so forth. It's a real good book. I can't remember the name of it, but he didn't write a whole lot of books. There'll only be two or three. They'll all be good, all three of them.
I'll try to track those down and put a link up. Awesome. Did you ever get the shotgun bug? I didn't ask you, like, what kind of guns do you shoot, and go down that rabbit hole?
When I first started hunting, I shot a 20 gauge Wingmaster.
Okay.
Remington 870. And then you have to get into the double guns then.
inevitable, but I was curious.
Yeah, and so I shot a Mossberg. I think they're like a silver
reserve or something. Feel like I've heard of that. Reserve. Yep.
Yeah. I bought one of those, and I bought it. It had a 2-barrel set.
Oh, really?
28 gauge and 20 gauge. Yeah.
No kidding.
And of course it was a 20 gauge frame. So it was still fairly heavy, but I shot it well. And then I shot a CZ-28 ring neck for many years.
Okay.
And I bought a new one. Oh, many years ago when I went to Montana, and I had a problem with it. It was a single trigger selective barrel. And when I would shoot, both barrels would go off.
Oh, yep. Doubled.
And so I called CZ, and they're handmade. And so none of the parts are interchangeable. And so they said probably just one of the trigger need adjusted. And they said, it was under warranty. If I'd send it in, they would repair it, send it back to me. And I said, well, bird season just opened. I don't want to give it up, So I started just shooting it as a single barrel.
Just one shot in it.
And I have to tell you, that was one of the best things I ever did because my shooting improved so much because you don't take bad shots then, and you're real selective on your shots when you just got one.
Yep.
And so my shooting percentage shot up to where I just didn't hardly miss with it, because I didn't take very many shots, basically, Well, so now I actually wanted to get it. I think they weighed more than 5 pounds. They were like 5 pounds.
That was a 28 gauge ring neck.
Yeah. 28 gauge. Yeah. I think. And so I was actually looking for an even lighter gun. So I was looking for some, like a single shot. Break open single shot and all the old single shots that you can find, like the Stevens or, all those old ones, they're smooth barrel. They don't have a ventilated rib on them at all. And so I got to looking at these they're really cheap guns. It's called a Hatfield single shot. And the only place they sell them is at Walmart, and they sell them for like $125. And so I thought, I'll give that a try. And so I bought one like 2 or 3 years ago, and they're really some of the reasons they're so cheap is they're fixed choke. They don't have choke cheeks, So I actually, when I bought it, it was a 28 inch barrel, and I like 26, and it was modified. So I cut the barrel off 2 inches with a hacksaw. And the man, I tell you what, I can shoot that gun.
Cylinder choke. Did they have it? Did you find it in 28 gauge or is it a 20 or what is it?
No, just a 20. They make them in 410.
That makes sense.
Which I didn't think I was that good of a shot to go to a 410.
Yeah.
But they're a tough gun to get used to because they're a hammer gun.
Okay.
But they also have a bar safety, like you'd find on an 870. You know, you got to push that button to release the safety.
Yeah.
And so for a while, you know, I'd come up on a point and I either wouldn't have it cocked or I would forget to turn the safety off. So it took me a while to get used to adjusting to make sure it was cocked.
Yeah.
So now whenever I go in on a point, I think it's cocked. Just got to turn the safety off now, you know, but I shoot it really well. I don't shoot it nearly as many birds as I used to,
yeah,
you know, but it's so cheap. And one of the other aspects about it I really like is it almost folds in half. And so I can fold it and it'll sit right on my shoulder to where I'm like hands free.
Sure.
And it just sit there and it's pretty ugly, you know, but you know, I've been pretty happy with it. I would like to go back to shooting a double barrel again at some time, but for right now it's working for me. And you know,
well, I am quite certain that the very first grouse I ever killed was killed with a single shot hammer gun 20 gauge from Walmart. But that grouse that grouse was, as we might say, that was in the pre-flight position, Mike. It was not on the wing, so the 10-year-old Nick didn't have any trouble working the hammer and safety at the time.
Yeah. Well, I think that the main reason I like this gun, it has a ventilated rib.
Okay. So it actually, it does have a rib on it, which, that you don't see that all the time on those little break open.
No, that's the only single shot. There probably is some more out there, different manufacturers, but that's the only one that I could find that had the ventilated rib because, you know, I wanted to get a single shot because that's all I was shooting in my CZ. I even after I got it fixed, I just kept just putting one shell in it, you know, even after it was shoot too.
Yeah. Well, single shot shotgun and a hacksaw, you got a quail gun, Mike.
But you know, there's the disadvantage to that is, you know, is then, you know, if they're starting to get, you know, like sharptail later in the season, they're going to be out farther. I can't hunt that gun, and so that's why I need to find another gun to hunt with it or buy another one and don't cut the barrel off.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Keep that modified choke in there.
Yeah. What's interesting is when the first 870, when I first started bird hunting with, it was an old one. It was built in like the early 70s. And that was before they had the, you know, choke tubes. And so I actually had three barrels for it.
Oh, really?
It had a cylinder, a modified and a full choke barrel. And so, you know, when I wanted to, you know, change, you know, like now you'd change the choke tubes, you know, I would change the whole barrel.
Yep. Now they figured out how to just change the tubes.
Yeah.
Do you still have the Wingmaster?
My son has it.
Okay.
Yeah. I gave it to my son. He used to bird hunt with me when he was younger. He doesn't hunt any now, but it's kind of an heirloom.
Yeah.
And so I gave it to him. I don't hunt anymore. It's got really nice wood on it. And you know, I was really afraid I was going to damage it or something, so he's got it now.
I know my dad still got, he's got a 12 gauge Wingmaster, and I never shot that one a whole lot, but it was always the shotgun that he had and still has it, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're very good guns, very good guns. I think the thing that I started not liking about it too was, you know, they have ejectors, you know, instead of extractors.
Right.
And so, you know, you shoot, then, you know, you're looking for your shell, and I'd always feel bad if I couldn't find my shell, you know, my hole. And so that's one of the reasons I like going to ones that just had extractors, because then you don't have to be looking for your empties.
Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, we covered some ground, and I really appreciated getting to know you a bit better. I know you've been listening to the show. We've been keeping in touch a little bit, but it was fun learning about how you got into bird hunting and hearing some stories about the dogs and quail, and you've been doing this for a long time. It doesn't sound like you're going to stop anytime soon.
Well, I hope not. I mean, it just depends on how long these old legs can keep going. And I think I've got a few more years left in me, I think.
Anything left on your list? I mean, is there a bird that you
or a hunt that you feel like you haven't done yet, or do you just like to do what you love to do?
Well, you know, I always felt like I wanted to go chukar hunting, you know.
Okay.
But I don't know if I could do it now. My knees are getting a little wobbly, and you know, it kind of just depends on if I think I can get myself in good enough shape to go chukar hunting. That's one of the things I still would like to do is, you know, go to the Great Basin out there and go chukar hunting, you know.
I know in some conversations with Chuck, you know, like a lot of things, there's to a certain extent, you can sort of chukar hunt. You don't have to be on the steepest of steep terrain. Certainly chukar live there, but you can find them in other areas. So knowing you and your background a bit more, I'm sure you could figure it out if you really wanted to do it.
Well, I think that is if I'm going to do it, I think I'm going to have to do it here quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of what my goal is if I can, to be quite honest with you, but that cold spell here in Kansas, you know, I'd sit around and didn't do anything but eat, you know, for about 10 days. And I think I put on about 10 pounds. So I think if I'm going to have to get in much better shape. So that's kind of my goal for this year, is to get in hopefully good enough shape. And if I don't do it this next coming year, I just don't know if I'll ever be able to do it, you know? So that's my goal. Hopefully this year I'll get out there and go to the Great Basin and chase some of the birds there.
Well, with this early spring, you get the weighted backpack and get out there and start rucking, following the dogs, and you got a long off season to get tuned up for it, Mike.
Yeah, I'm gonna give it a try.
And if you do it, you let me know, and I'd love to have you back on. We can talk about your chukar hunt or anything.
You bet.
All right, buddy. Well, I really do appreciate it. It was fun to connect for this episode. Thanks for taking the time to join us on this episode of the podcast. That does it for this episode, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.